how good people fall. Probably we've all known some good people who fell. Probably we ourselves have fallen at one time or another in one way or another. But we want to look at this, and I want to start by telling you a story that you're probably familiar with. But I want to share it with you. You've probably read it a number of times. You've probably heard it preached. Certainly different portions of it, perhaps not the entire thing. So I want to share that story with you. There was a king. We know this king. We're very familiar with him. He's probably our favorite king from the Bible, King David. And David had a problem. He had several problems that we're going to get to, but his first problem was that it was the time for kings to go out to war. And he didn't go. He stayed home. And so while his army and his commanders were all off fighting wars for Israel, he was at home bored with nothing to do. So one night he got up and decided to go for a walk on the roof of his house. Now, of course, the houses in that day and age were flat on top, had a flat area to walk on top, not sloped like most of our houses. So he got up on top of the roof and he's walking around. And of course, his palace, being the king's palace, is taller than a lot of the other houses, and he's up on the roof of that, and he's looking around at his city. And as he looks around, he notices over in the courtyard of a neighboring house, there's a naked woman. She's taking a bath in the privacy of her fenced-in courtyard. You know, a lot of it's amazing. I've heard people try to blame her for, well, why is she doing outside taking a bath? Well, that's the way they took that. But she had, it was enclosed. Nobody was supposed to be able to see. She was supposed to be having privacy. But, well, she wasn't counting on the king of Israel being up on the roof of his house looking down on her. Well, apparently it wasn't quite dark, obviously. So when we say at night, it wasn't like, you know, dark nighttime, or he wouldn't have been able to see the naked woman. But it was bright enough in the day still that he saw her, and she wasn't an ugly woman. She was a good-looking woman. And so he kept looking. And then he got to thinking, you know, I wouldn't mind having her for my own for a little while. So he asked around, hey, you know, that house over across the road there, whose house is that? And they told him, well, that's the house of Uriah, and you know, he's off in battle with your army right now. His wife's there alone, he's not there. He said, huh, well, that's interesting. Thank you for telling me that. So he sent for Bathsheba, that was Uriah's wife's name, sent for her and had her come to his palace. Now, you know, what a great honor. It's not just everyone who gets invited to the king's palace. This is a special occasion. So she's invited to the king's palace, where he uses his wiles and his charms and perhaps his power as king and whatever else it might be, her loneliness because her husband's at war, whatever other factors may have played into it, and he has sexual relations with her. He sleeps with her. Well, she goes back home. No one's the wiser, right? Just a harmless little affair. Gave her some company while her husband was gone. Gave the king some happiness for one night. Nobody's hurt, right? Well, it would have seemed that way, or at least it did to David, until he got a message from Bathsheba. And the message said, I'm pregnant. My husband's at war. You're the only other man I've been with. Guess whose baby it is? That might not have been quite that long, but that's the gist of it. I'm pregnant. The rest may have been inferred. Husband's at war. We were just together. You know, okay. This is serious stuff. So David, having gotten away with the first part of his plan, and then had this little hiccup, thinks, well, I'll solve this problem as well. So he sends to his commander, Joab, and says, hey, send me Uriah. Now, at first, David thinks, I'm just going to cover up the fact that this is my baby. So he has Uriah come back home, and he invites him in, and he says, okay, hey, how are things going with the battle? You know, what's happening, and all these kind of things. And he asks Uriah all sorts of questions, and Uriah answers them. He's been at the front, and, you know, all these things have happened, and so forth. And then they have dinner together, you know, and then... David says, hey, you know what? It's too late tonight for you to go back. So just go home, spend the night home with your wife tonight, and then everything will be okay. We'll send you on your way tomorrow. Now his plan was, if Uriah goes home and spends the night with his wife, and then she's pregnant, well, no big deal, right? Because everybody will just assume, well, that's Uriah's wife. It's Uriah's baby. I mean, that just makes sense. The problem is, Uriah doesn't cooperate with David's plan. Uriah doesn't understand what's at stake here. He doesn't know anything about this. Uriah is a very honorable man, and he says, you know what? The Ark of the Covenant's out there. The army of Israel and Judah is out there sleeping in tents, sleeping on the ground. I can't go home to my wife while they're, I can't do that. So he just stays at the door of the palace that night. And he spends the night with there where David's servants sleep. The next day, David finds out that Uriah didn't go home. He's upset. But we'll get this. So he says, you know what? What we'll do is stay here one more day. I've got some other things, before I send you back, and I gotta get some things to Joab, but you just wait, stay another day. And then that night, again, he has him in to eat. Well, this time he gives him a lot of wine, gets him drunk. He says, surely if I get this guy drunk, I mean, his animal instincts are going to take over, right? I mean, a drunk man who's got a pretty wife like Bathsheba at home, surely he'll go home to her, right? And so he gets him drunk, and then he sends him to go, and, well, unfortunately, again, Uriah didn't go back home. He stayed right there at the door of the palace and slept the night there. So in the morning, David says, well, I've got to come up with another plan. So he comes up with an even worse plan than the first plan. First plan was bad enough, but this one's even worse. David writes a letter to Commander Joab, and he says, hey, Joab, got something for you to do that I need you to do for me. I wonder what Uriah would have thought if he'd have opened that letter and read it on the way. Uriah takes his own death notice back, never imagining, trusting his king, who's supposed to have the best interests of the nation and its citizens in mind. But he trusts his king, and so he takes the letter, and the letter tells Joab, here's what you do. You fight right up to the edge of the wall, because Uriah had told him what the circumstances were. So you fight right up to the edge, right up to the wall, and make sure Uriah is in the front row. And said, when you get up there right by the wall, everybody else retreat, but don't tell Uriah to retreat. Leave him by the wall. So they fought up to the wall. They're fighting the battle. And then everybody retreats except Uriah, and he's left to fight the enemy army by himself. You can guess how that turned out. Uriah's killed. So Joab sends another messenger to tell David, hey, here's what happened. And he tells the messenger, he said, you tell him say, look, we fought up to the wall. Say, you know, we were ready. We thought we were going to capture the city, but, you know, and we pulled back and said, you know, we didn't get the city, but we're about ready to take it. But, hey, your servant Uriah died in the battle. And so the messenger comes, brings the message to David, and he tells David and explains everything. And so David sent the messenger back and said, well, you tell Joab, it's okay. There's no way to anticipate these kind of things are going to happen sometimes. That's the way it is. You just go ahead and conquer that city. And you encourage Joab to go ahead and conquer the city. So now David's taken care of his problem. For the most part, nobody that matters, because servants didn't matter, nobody that matters knows about David and Bathsheba. Everybody knows Uriah came back, but nobody really knows that he didn't go home to his wife. And so now we have this widow Bathsheba who's going to have a baby. That's okay. And so David does the honorable thing as a king, who one of his soldiers has been struck down by the enemy, and after her time of mourning is over, he takes Bathsheba into the fold to take care of her. Takes her for his wife. Not that he didn't already have enough wives, but he's going to be the honorable king who's going to take Bathsheba, and she's pregnant with Uriah's child, and I'll raise this child as my own. Well, of course he would, it's his child. But nobody knows that. And so everything has worked out. Until Nathan the prophet comes. And Nathan comes to David and he says, David, there's something we need to talk about. And he says, let me tell you a story. Just like I've been telling you this story today, Nathan says, David, let me tell you this story. He said, there was this guy who was rich and he had a whole bunch of sheep. And his neighbor was a poor man, and his poor neighbor only had one little sheep. And he loved that little sheep, and he kept that little sheep in his house with him, treated it like a child. He said, well, what happened was there was this visitor that came to visit the rich man. But this horrible rich man, instead of killing one of his sheep to feed it to his visitor, he went and got that poor neighbor man's only sheep and stole it from him and killed that sheep and cooked it and fed that to his visitor. Oh, David is enraged by this. The thought that a man would steal his neighbor's sheep when he had so many sheep and feed it to a visitor instead of killing one of his own sheep to show the hospitality that he should. This is a horrible man. Who is this guy? We need to find him. I'll have him executed. And then Nathan says some of the most powerful words in all of Scripture. You're the man. And I'm sure it took a minute for David to realize what he's doing. What a sheep. I hadn't fed anybody else. I hadn't stolen anybody's sheep. And then it dawns on him. He knows exactly what I've done. This prophet of God knows I didn't just steal a sheep. I stole the man's wife. And, you know, as angry as he was at the rich man in the story, I mean, hey, the rich guy could just give the guy another sheep. And I know it wouldn't quite take the place of the one he loved, but at least he'd still have a sheep. He didn't just steal the man's sheep. He didn't just steal the man's wife. He killed the man. David's so much worse than the man in Nathan's story. And David recognizes that he has condemned himself. And Nathan says, I chose you to be the king over Israel, and I rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house. And I gave you the houses of Judah and Israel And if that wasn't enough, I would have given you more. I loved you. Was the man after my own heart. I loved you. I would have given you anything that you asked me for. Why have you despised me and my commandments so much as to take this man's wife after you murdered him? Now, God here paints the picture that even if you have somebody killed by somebody else, you're still the murderer. David was still guilty of the murder, even though, well, it was the enemy army that killed him. I didn't do it. Yes, you did. You're a murderer. He says, the sword's never going to depart from your house. You've despised me. You've taken another man's wife to be yours. You've killed the man. I'm going to bring disaster on your house. And he said, you know what? What you did in the dark. But I am going to take your wives and hand them over to somebody else, and I'm going to do it in broad daylight for everybody to see. It won't be a secret. God fulfilled that a little later on, by the way, when Absalom took his father's palace and David was on the run, and Absalom set up a tent on the top of the roof where everybody could see it and slept with all of his father's concubines and wives. He said, you've done it in secret, but I'm going to do it in broad daylight. I'll make sure everybody sees it when I do it, when I make it happen to you. David, of course, says, I've sinned. I'm a horrible person. Look what I've done. And Nathan says, yes, you have. God's forgiven you. You're not going to die for this. Even though you deserve to, you're not going to die. But because of what you've done, the son that's going to be born is going to die. In some ways, this is worse punishment for David than if he had died. His son, his baby, is going to pay the consequences for his sin. That doesn't seem fair. David prayed and prayed when the child was born. Child was very sick. He prayed and he prayed. Everybody was afraid to, you know, they wanted him to eat. He wouldn't eat. He wouldn't sleep. He just cried and prayed all day and all night. And then when finally the child did die, the servants were scared to death. They said, if he acted this way while the child was still alive, now that the child's dead, what is he going to do? Who's going to tell him that the child's dead? They didn't want to tell him. Finally, they'd been hiding it from him a little while, but they were afraid, you know, he's going to commit suicide or something if we tell him that the baby's dead. David saw that they were whispering to each other, and he figured it out. He said, the child's dead, isn't he? And they said, yes, he's dead. David got up, took a bath, groomed himself, went to worship God, went to eat. Interesting order there, isn't it? Hadn't eaten anything for days. He gets up, takes a bath, grooms himself, goes to worship God, and then eats. People ask, "What? What? This is crazy. While the child was alive, you were mourning like he's dead. Now he's dead, and you're, you know, going about life like it's normal again." And David explains, he said, while the child was alive, I thought just maybe God would have mercy on me and spare the child. But once he died, I knew that God had done what he said he would do. And there was no more reason to mourn. He said, he will never come back to me, but I will go to him. There's some things we need to learn from that story. There's a lot of things we could learn from that story. But we want to focus on how did a good man like David A man after God's own heart. How did he fall like this? First of all, let's look. Sin's progression. Irresponsibility. He was not doing what he was supposed to do. We have the old saying, idle hands are devil's workshop, or an idle mind is the devil's workshop. Both of them are true. If David had been at war like he was supposed to be, none of this would have happened. If he'd have been leading his troops in battle as the kings of his day did, this would not have happened. But he was irresponsible. And then, of course, there was lust. You know, there are a couple things that can happen when a man sees an unclothed woman. He can be very embarrassed by it and turn away. Or he can keep looking in lust. David chose the second of those. When he, you know, he could have easily looked up, oh, there's a naked woman over there. But instead, David said, oh, there's a naked woman over there. Get a better look. And he began to lust. That desire, that lust led to his secret sin. He sent for Bathsheba and he slept with her. He didn't think anybody knew. It was a secret. But then the deception to try to bring Uriah in to try to cover up the secret sin. And he was also trying to protect, to some degree, Bathsheba. If it was found that she was pregnant while her husband was away, she would have been killed as an adulteress. Even if she claimed, well, but it was the king, it's the king's baby. Who's going to believe her? I mean, he's the king. Nobody's going to believe her over the king. So he tries the deception. And that's the way it is with us too. When we lust, we have a desire. And it may not be a sexual sin like David's was. But any sin in our life, this desire we have, and so we try to do it secretly so nobody knows. And then we try to deceive to cover it up. And then there's treachery involved. We get to the point where we would lie, steal, kill. We'd do anything to cover up the sin so nobody finds out about it. The treachery involved in David's sin. And then seeming success. Everything's better. It's all over. We can relax now. No. Because then comes exposure. Now here's the thing. Sometimes that seeming success lasts throughout your entire life. There are some people who go to their graves carrying their secret sins that nobody on earth knows about. But there's still exposure. Their sins will be exposed on the day of judgment. Moses said it very clearly, be sure your sin will find you out. It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, it may not even be in this life, but for sure on the day of judgment, those secret sins will be open for everyone to see. They'll be exposed. And then, of course, the consequences. David had to deal with the consequences of his in this life. God forgave him, but he still had to deal with the consequences of that child dying. It's an amazing thing when we think about this. There are three hazardous conditions that happen. And any one of these can throw us for a loop spiritually. But when all three are mixed together, it's a particularly lethal concoction that will get us without a doubt. First, a season of unusual failure or success. If things are going really bad, we're more easily tempted. If things are going really good, we're more easily tempted. Pride goes before destruction, remember. When things are going great, we think we've got everything under control, look out. That's when we're going to trip and fall on our face. When things are going really bad, that's when we... You know, I was talking to somebody recently, you know, they were telling me all the tragedies in their life. And the last one is the worst one. They became a drug addict. Because, you know, they had a spouse die, they had a house burned down, they lost a business, and they turned to drugs and made the situation even worse. But so many times when we're having bad things happen, we turn to sin. Instead of turning to God, we turn to sin. 2 Chronicles 26, 15 and 16. I'm not going to read these. We don't have time to look at all these. But Deuteronomy 8, 10 through 14. Proverbs 30, 8 and 9. All of these talk about this. And we find failure and success are equally dangerous. It's not like one's going to give it to you and the other one's not. They both cause problems. What happens is when we're at our lowest and when we're at our highest, we show who we really are. That's when the real person is revealed, is under those circumstances. How somebody acts on a normal day when everything's kind of okay and they can keep up their facade of this is who I pretend to be to everybody is not who they are when they become powerful and wealthy and everything rich and everything's going their way, and it's not who they are when everything's going against them. That's when you find out who you really are. It's when there's either great success. How do you handle that? It's one of the reasons lottery winners' lives get destroyed. Because they don't know, all that success, all that wealth, it just destroys them. They don't know what to do with it. And the same thing with failures and problems. A pattern of self-deception. And David certainly did this. He deceived himself into thinking that he could hide this from God. Really? Did you think God wouldn't notice? Proverbs 7, 6 through 23, Romans 7, 14 through 25, 1 Corinthians 6, 18, and 1 Corinthians 10, 11 and 12. The idea, I'm strong enough to handle what others can't. I don't need to do these things that other people do. I don't need to go to church. I don't need to study my Bible. I don't need to pray. I can handle it. I'm stronger than them. That's a lie. And you're deceiving yourself. And then, of course, secrets. Proverbs 9, 17 and 18, Jeremiah 23, 24, Proverbs 5, 21 through 23, Psalm 32, 3 through 5, Psalm 19, 12, Romans 2, 16, and Proverbs 28, 13. All talk about secrets. Secrets are not healthy. Secrets kill. They kill us physically. They can kill us spiritually. They can kill us emotionally. So, where in this progression of sin are you in your life? Are you at a stage of irresponsibility where you're in danger of falling? Have you already got a desire that you're struggling with? Have you already committed the sin and you're keeping it a secret from others? Are you practicing deception to continue that sin while keeping it hidden from others? Are you to the point where you have some sort of treachery that you are committing, adding sin upon sin in these situations? Or are you at the stage where you think you've got it, yeah, it's pretty well covered up, nobody knows? Has it been exposed? Or are you at the point where you need to expose it to get it out of your life? The problem with secret sin is it will fester, and you'll keep it hidden from everyone except God. He'll see it. Are you ready to face the consequences? Because if you don't expose your secret sin, if you don't overcome that secret sin, it will be exposed on Judgment Day and you'll be destroyed forever. How much are we like David? We've all been down this pattern more than once. More than once. Bob was telling us Wednesday night about one of his bad sins when he lied to his wife about mopping the floor and it got exposed and he had to face the consequences. It was better that it got exposed and he faced the consequences then than to have to face them later. It always gets worse later on. If you're here and you need to respond to God's invitation for any reason, if there is sin in your life that you need help getting that out, getting rid of it, whatever your need may be, please come as we stand and as we sing.